You're listening to the Mindful Marketing Show podcast, episode 61.
Welcome to the Mindful Marketing Show with Kimberly Maska. You are about to be empowered as we teach you the best marketing strategies used by today's spiritual entrepreneurs. Get ready to share your message and inspire people worldwide.
Hello, I am Kimberly Maska, your mindful marketer, and I would like to welcome you to the Mindful Marketing Show, the podcast for spiritual entrepreneurs who are ready to change the world with their gift and have a business that reflects their authentic self. I know how frustrating it can be to launch a new business, so I have a free gift for you. It is the Jumpstart Your Spiritual Business Guide. In it, you will find all of the tools you need to, well, jumpstart your spiritual business and create an abundance of time, money, and freedom. Don't wait to share your gift with the world. Get your copy of Jumpstart Your Spiritual Business today at mindfulmarketingshow.com. Now, before we jump in, this episode is brought to you by Kickstart Cart, my shopping cart of choice for myself and my clients. It has everything you need to create the business of your dreams with passive income, or as I like to call it, make money while you meditate. Picking the right shopping cart for your business is a big deal, and it can also be very confusing. So what I have done is created a free workshop for you to help you through the decision-making process. You can find this free shopping cart workshop at mindfulmarketingshow.com/kickstart. That is mindfulmarketingshow.com/kickstart. Now let's listen to this episode. Hello and welcome. I am Kimberly Maska, your host of Mindful Marketing, the podcast where today's mind, body, spirit thought leaders discuss the latest strategies to build your business and take the icky out of marketing. Joining us today is Jan Phillips. Jan is an evolutionary artist, award-winning author, and dynamic speaker. She is known for using the arts to keep the brain and heart connected. She creates a unique multi-sensory experience, weaving humor, storytelling, imagery, and music to ignite insights for life-changing action. She has performed with Pete Seeger, taught with Jane Goodall, and worked with Mother Teresa. She interviewed Barbara Marks Hubbard for Barbara's last book, Birth 2012 and Beyond. Thank you so much, Jan, for joining me today. How are you?
I'm doing just great, and thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. So I've read over your bio, and you seem to have a beautiful and amazing experience. Let's hear about your journey, about how you ended up where you are today, and in sharing all this enlightening information.
Well, interestingly enough, I started out trying to be a nun. So I was in the convent until the age of 20, when my superiors realized it was a bad fit because I was looking more and more like a union organizer in a Walmart to them. So they kicked me out. And then I didn't know how to create a life because I had known I was going to be a nun ever since I was 12. So I had no idea how to imagine something different. So when it came time for me to figure out, if I can't be a nun, what am I going to be? I tried to pick a career that was as close to nun as I could, which to me was social worker. And so I became a social worker. And then that began to feel a little bit small when I was, in hindsight, I can describe it like this. I was being Mother Teresa when I was really designed to be Gandhi.
Ah, interesting.
And so I became a social activist because, you know, Mother Teresa addressed the consequences of poverty one individual at a time. And so did I when I worked with her over there in Calcutta. We would get one orphan at a time out of dire circumstances. But eventually it occurred to me in my consciousness that the problem was structural. And so to address what's wrong with the system or what's wrong with the structure or the architecture. And so that was when I made my shift from being more a social activist than a social worker. And as a social activist, then you think more globally or nationally. And that's when I started with a group of four other people, an organization called Syracuse Culture Workers, which was a business designed to use the arts to raise public awareness of global issues. And we were progressive, kind of leftist, progressive individuals. And so peace and justice, that was our bailiwick, as they say. And so we created peace calendars and posters and note cards. And I'm an artist, and several of the others were too. So as a photographer, I contributed my images of peace and justice oriented images. And on that path, somebody once left a copy of a book on my workbench, which was called The Hundredth Monkey. And I read that book on my lunch hour, and that caused me to think even more globally and to start a savings account to make a peace pilgrimage around the world as a peace activist and photographer. And that's the thing that really transformed me into an artist activist. And I never thought of making much of a business or career out of that. It was just always like the mission. I was kind of like an apostle on this mission. And I would do any odd job in order to pay the rent, because I had figured out I could live simply enough after being in a convent while I was preparing to take vows of poverty. Materialism never was a big deal for me. So I never needed like $75,000 a year to live. I could live easily enough on 25 or 30. So at the same time that I was simplifying my life, I made this peace pilgrimage around the world. And as a result of that, my life was transformed from a political activist to I would say spiritual contemplative. And because of the magnitude of that transformation, I had to try and figure out what the hell just happened to me over the course of that year. How does one get changed from a extrovert to an from a contemplative, you know, it's from an activist to a contemplative. It was just a total mystery to me. So the only way I know to figure out some big thing that happened to me is to externalize it. So I wrote a book about it in order to figure out what had happened. It was just chronologically, okay, chapter one, Japan, chapter two, China, chapter three, Thailand. So I took the 20 countries I had gone through to say what happened to me in those places. And as a result of getting that one book published, I was invited to teach at a week-long women's writers conference. And that was the event that changed the trajectory of my life, because in that week I discovered that women have been not unequivocally silenced. We have been silenced in so many ways by our families and churches and institutions and businesses and corporations and every organization we're a part of, where the male voice is predominant and the women's voice is silenced. That imbalance led me to then realize, I have to dedicate my whole life. I have to figure out how to make a living as an artist and become a workshop presenter, so that I can do the undoing of the problem that exists. So I was probably in my late 30s, early 40s when that happened. And so I began to build up steam and momentum and figured out how to make my living as a facilitator and writer and creative artist. And now I know how to do it really well. And I've made my living. I have two houses. I live on the East Coast and the West Coast, and I've been successful at it. And there's no stress to me. Marketing is as fun for me as writing books, writing songs and making CDs or making YouTube videos. It's all fun.
That's fantastic. Not everybody has that same outlook. I look at marketing and I go, oh, I hate it.
No, I love it.
So what do you think are some of the challenges in the mind, body, spirit community of getting past that marketing, you know, the icky, and how do you make it fun?
Well, I think there's a kind of false humility that anybody who's been conditioned anyhow by any religious tradition has this thing to overcome called humility. You should be humble. And that, I think, is a big stopping point, because when you do your marketing, you have to be able to acknowledge you're an expert in something. And you have to be able to defend that and say, I'm an expert in this because of A, B, and C. And that sounds what traditionally might be called egotistical or the opposite of selfless, you know, it just sounds self-centered. But you have to be self-centered. In order for your marketing to work, I mean, there has to be something pretty large inside yourself if you are trying to get people to exchange money for what you're giving them. You have to say, I have great treasures inside me, and I will pour them out in front of you, and it will add great value to your life. And in exchange, I want you to help me pay my mortgage. I mean, that's a bargain that you have to really defend and be able to say, why should people pay $500 to come to me for a weekend and learn what they think is facilitator training? You know, and at the end, they all go, oh, my God, I would have paid $1,000 for this.
And you're like, I have to adjust my prices.
I mean, you really have to figure out what you're worth, what's your value, and be able to tell the story in a convincing way. I think it's all story-driven, everything story-driven, because if you can't tell a compelling story about why you're worth whatever people are going to give you for being in your presence, then you got to be a good storyteller before anything else. And so your marketing, all of our marketing, is just a way of saying to the world, hey, here's the value I add. If you need it, then I got it. And because, you know, 90% of the people I encounter don't need what I offer, but those 2% need it really bad, or 10% or whatever's left after whatever number I just threw out. But, you know, it's like the Balinese dancer who said, there's someone out there who needs you. Live your life so they can find you.
Oh, I love that. I absolutely love it, because that's so true. And that's one of the points I like to drive home with my clients, is that if they can't find you, you can't help them. They have to know where you are.
Right. So that's why the word platform is a big, fat, important word, which is a kind of industry stupid word, because why don't you just say audience? It makes more sense. But every industry likes to have its own elite language. And so the language of our industry is called the platform. And so if you're just like, I just had a half an hour call. I gave a half an hour away to a millennial who just did a year-long journey in an RV interviewing millennials around the country, and now she wants to do a book. But she doesn't have a platform. So we have to create the conversation about, well, how do you build a platform? What does one do now? Because it's not the same as it was 5 years ago or 10 years ago, you know, to create your audience. It's changing week by week, as we know.
The blink of an eye, it's a different way to create that platform.
Yeah, and I don't even know I have never even visited Instagram or Tumblr. I have no idea what they mean or read it. But I have my own way, and it's working for me. And so I think it's up to every person who is ready to begin a marketing campaign to be able to say, in the following media formats, I can make a compelling case for the value that I add. There's all kinds of me, a 5-minute, 3-minute, direct from my iPhone uploads of me sitting there talking about why your creativity is important, not just to you, but to the world. You know, so if you visit Jan Phillips on YouTube, You get me fleshed out within 5 seconds. I'm all fleshed out. And a person's going to say, oh, my God, I love her. I'm signing up for my next thing. Or the next person's going to say, oh, my God, she's way too aggressive and loudmouth, and I can't deal with that. So I'm not going to go there. And I don't care. The only thing I care about is that what's coming out of me is real and spontaneous and immediate. I never have a script. Because I think they're deadening, you know. I don't want to watch somebody's eyes move on those things they read on a television thing, you know. So then I say this, if you're afraid of not having your material together, then just shorten your message. But, you know, speak right from your heart.
So the importance of being authentic when we're in front of the camera or even just in our writing is so important.
I was making a CD the other day, and I said to my record producer, listen to me. So I say to my producer, David, this has to be my last CD because I feel my voice is weakening and I don't have the control I used to have. my voice isn't as good as it used to be. He goes, hey, this has got nothing to do with good. Do you think that ever stopped Bob Dylan or Leonard Cohen? It's not about good. It's about real.
Yeah, and that's what people love. They love the real side. There's so much of the non-real out there. It's really refreshing, frankly, when you find someone that's the real you.
So I have two tips for people who are marketing, is to be able to say two different things. One is find three things you connect the dots between and let that be your fallback. If somebody says in the elevator, what do? I say, I connect the dots between creativity, spirituality, and social action. And then they know what I do. And then they can say, hey, that turns me on, or okay, bye. And I care. You know, I know everyone's not for me, but I know there's a lot of people trying to figure out how to connect those dots. All those people out there, millions and millions, who are leaving churches and saying they're spiritual but not religious, that's my audience. So I'm helping them. And the other thing to do is figure out what to say you're a mashup between two people. Because if you ever listen to a film critic and they're describing the movie, they'll always say something like, oh, it's Flying Nun meets Dracula.
That's a really good point. I like that.
So you have to say a mashup. And so if I say I'm a mix of Joseph Campbell meets Catherine of Siena, that's going to say something to the people who care about my work. People who don't know the name Catherine of Siena or Joseph Campbell, I don't care about them because they're not on the same path as me. Right?
So true.
Use the buzzwords, you know, and I might say I'm a mashup between Gloria Steinem and Mother Teresa, you know.
That's right.
What does that say? It says you're a feminist, and it says you have something to do with spirituality and service.
That's great. And you know what? Because we all look to someone that we kind of model and admire. So I think that helps too, keep our focus as well. Because if you're a mashup of those two people, then it's going to keep you focused on what their goals are as well. And that's a really great way to do that.
So you got to give people pictures, you know, because all this esoteric stuff that people spend days figuring out, what's their mission statement, what's their value proposition, what's their unique blah-de-blah, USP, you know, all that stuff that you'd pay a coach thousands of dollars to help you do, that ain't it. That's just too many words. You got to just be able to deliver the goods on the spot. And if you get it down to your mashup and what you connect the dots between, then that helps people get the picture. And it separates you from the rest because everyone else is trying to put too many words on a sheet of paper.
Yeah. And it gets jumbled. And you don't know what they're talking about anymore. Then you lose them.
And the days of the brochure are over.
The attention span of everybody is so small now. It's like you've got to be able to nail it in a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
So who is your ideal client, though? Let's talk about that and how you market to that ideal client.
Well, I don't know that I have an ideal client, but the people who are trying to find me are people who care about what used to be called religion, like they have their roots. They want to do some service, and that usually comes from what they learned as a kid from religion. It's like charity is an important part of your good life, doing service. And so they want to be true. Who can be, you know, it's hard to be a religious believer anymore because the churches are just proposing ridiculous ideas that hurt people more than they help people in general. And so, you know, my roots, of course, are Catholic. And Pope Francis is doing a great job, but he still won't let women have any power. You know, I'm not going to ever return to the Catholic Church. Why would I do that? I'm a priest of the imagination. So my audience are people that have pretty much abandoned old notions of, you know, what we formerly referred to as religion or as mission-oriented work in the world. They haven't dropped that idea of I want to be useful and I want to give service, because that's what provides us with meaning and the bliss and the value in our lives. You know, I've run into so many baby boomers who have too much time on their hands and they don't know what to do with their time because they haven't got the formula that you got to be of use. In order to feel good about who you are, you can't just be reading novels all day and going to the spa. You can do that a third of the time, but the one third has to be being helpful to somebody. So I'd have to admit to you that I'd say 80% of the money I make on PayPal comes from nuns buying my music.
Oh, interesting.
I would say nuns, even though they all have a vow of poverty and they live on like $60 a month, they give more than half of it to me.
That's amazing.
Why is that? It's because I write books that challenge, that bring them along out of their bondage. I unshackle their shackles. And I have the keys to the kingdom of themselves. I have the keys that unlock them for their own greater imagining of their own divine being. I have those keys. And so they pay me money and they pay my bills and they help me buy my second house. These are small time, you'd put them in the petty category. You'd put them in the, these are not the big bucks people. And yet, if you looked at my PayPal orders, you would see 80% of them say Sister So-and-So.
Wow. So how did you get that audience? How did you market to them to get in front of them?
Because when I describe myself, I say Jan Phillips's journey has taken her in and out of a religious community around the United States on a Honda motorcycle and around the world on a year-long peace pilgrimage. That provides three telling things. One is she's one of us. She was in a religious community. She's got some courage if she rode, she's got some chutzpah. If she rode a motorcycle across the country, she's not afraid. Religious communities are driven by fear in many regards now because they're becoming obsolete and they're dying out. So fear is a really strong and prevailing emotion. So they know I have no fear. And then she made a peace pilgrimage around the world. Oh, peace and justice drives religious communities. So she's still one of us.
All comes back to the story, your 3 points. I like that.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So are you using, on the more practical side of things, for the actual marketing out to people? Are you using social media, and what works for you?
I use Constant Contact for my major mailing list. I have like 9,000 people on Constant Contact, 3,000 of whom regularly open up the mail. So that's a good, strong lot of people who adore me.
That's a fantastic number, yes.
And they all race right back. Whenever I get lonely, I send out a newsletter because I need to hear from them. And I always give them New Yorker cartoons. I give them little Mary Oliver poems or Hafiz poems. I give them quotes from the text that I'm reading. And I give them what I call my Paul to the Corinthians, only better. My little letter to them that says, I know what you're going through, and I believe in you.
That's beautiful. That's the inspiration everybody looks for in their inbox, right?
Yep. And they tell me they read it. It's the only newsletter of all the ones they get, they read. I don't do it for me because I know as a marketer, if it looks like marketing, I'm going to get 20 unsubscribes immediately.
Right.
But if it looks like my Thanksgiving gift to them, then I get 20 new subscribes. So that to me is the most important thing to know about marketing. That if you probably ask 50% of my people, does Jan Phillips do marketing in the newsletter? Oh no, she doesn't do that. She writes us this great letter. She sends us funny New Yorker cartoons, and she gives us Mary Oliver poems. They don't even notice the box that says I'll be in the following cities on these dates.
they just glaze over it. And it's because you're, you know, you're making their day beautiful. So it's that's what they're focusing on, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
Do you use the, you know, big Facebook or anything like that? Do you tweet?
I have a tweet account that whenever somebody sends me a delicious, you know, short YouTube video or poignant anything, I tweet it. But I don't tweet. I don't know how many followers I have. I don't tweet as a, you know, regular thing. I just know there's probably 500 people out there that actually understand Twitter. I'm not one of them. But I know if I send them a thing and it says, click here for the delight of your day, they're going to do it and they're going to pass it on. So they're my troops. I think of them as my troops. They're like my little Paul Revere's. They pass on the good news.
That's great.
And what else do I do? Facebook. I do as a non-professional. I just do it as, you know, Jan Phillips, the fun-loving artist. I post on there about, you know, I have a foundation. I raised all the money I can. I'm building a school in Nigeria, right? So everyone knows I raise money by having a women's creativity symposium. So on my Facebook page, I put my stuff about that women's symposium because Jan Phillips doesn't do anything that's not fun. And so an announcement about anything I'm involved with is good news. It's like, you're going to want to know about this because this is too much fun not to come to. Because my commitment primarily is fun, joy, bliss. And oh, by the way, your creativity is going to get unlocked. You're going to take part in a, you know, sacramental feeling rituals, and you're going to be part of a community that will change your life for the rest of it. And so I post stuff on Facebook that one might think of as marketing, but it's just me. It feels like Jan's just sharing the good news.
That's great. That's how it should feel. You don't want to ever be sold to. Just talk to us and share your life.
Yeah.
So now, with your books, you have many, many, many books out there. So what has been the process for that? And what did you learn through the process? Did you self-publish? Did you go with the traditional publisher? Or maybe both? You have so many, there might be a mixture there. And what kind of recommendations can you give to authors?
I did a combination of both. Most of my books have been published by traditional presses, but what I'm discovering now is they don't give a hoot about your book. They got a lot of shit they're dealing with, and so they don't think of my book like I think of it. And so I probably sell as many books of my own because I'm in workshops all the time. And so as an artist trying to make a living in the world, when the conversation goes toward finances, I have to say to myself, okay, do I want to make money on this book or do I want to expand the audience? Because those are two different choices. And I make a lot of money on a book I publish. For example, the last book I published was No Ordinary Time, The Rise of Spiritual Intelligence and Evolutionary Creativity. It's a book of hours. I printed 1,000, they sold in a few weeks. I printed another 1,000, they sold in a month. Then I printed 5,000, they're still selling. When I print the book, I pay a buck and a half, $2 for it. It sells for 16. So there is a lot of margin there.
They're good numbers.
Those are good numbers. You know, the publisher always said to me, their ratio, Quest Books ratio, was 8 times the price of what it costs to print is what they put on the for sale retail price. So if they, I think with Marry Your Muse, it cost them $3 to print, and the price is like 24, something like that. $2 at first printing, it was $18. So I figured, oh, that cost them what, $2 to print or so, I don't know, whatever the math is. So anyway, now I had my last, and every single book I ever published or any press published has a nice gold sticker on it or two or three because I'm an award-winning writer. And now I'm mad because the last publisher, in order to win prizes, you got to pay an entry fee and get the book in front of the judges. And my last publisher, I think, was too cheap to do that. And now, it's the only book I have, it doesn't have a gold sticker on it. Aww. So I emailed them today, and I said, Eric Hoffer Award considers books published in the last 2 years. If you guys haven't submitted this book, please do. And if you're not going to, let me know, because I want a gold sticker on that book. So there's a lot that you sacrifice. But if you're an author who does not have a platform, otherwise known as big audience, what good is it going to do for me to have 5,000 books in the shed in my backyard?
You make a coffee table out of them.
Right. So I sell them on Amazon. And I probably sell, I don't know, 50 or 60 a month on Amazon. People who don't know me, have never been to a workshop, just their friends read it, they're in the book club, blah de blah. So they order it from Amazon. But mostly I sell my books at my workshops and off my website. And I just had a 2-for-1 sale at Christmas time. I called it a short sale because it was only 2 days long, because it could break the bank. But every book anyone ordered and paid for, I sent them two of.
Nice.
So I do extravagant things like that just to shake it up.
Well, it's good to give them something a little interesting to play with. I like that, the short sale.
Yeah, so because I think giving is receiving.
Yeah.
So I never can be generous enough.
So with your workshops, is that where you're getting, how are you getting your clients or people into the workshops? How do you notify them of what's happening?
Well, my newsletter. My constant contact communication is called the Muse Letter because I have a book called Marry Your Muse. So the Muse Letter, it usually arrives approximately once a month in everyone's boxes. And if I have a new discovery or a new invention or something cool, I'll just send that out and go mini Muse Letter. And that happened last month. I created a new workshop called Story Spinning. So I said, okay, I'm going to do a local story spinning 8-week course in San Diego. And I'm going to offer a weekend story spinning retreat from Thursday through Sunday at my lodge. I have a 6-bedroom lodge on a lake in upstate New York. I'm going to offer it at Muse Lodge. So I sent it out, and within one day, I have both workshops totally booked, overbooked.
That's a nice idea.
I have 10 people that signed up for story spinning at Muse Lodge, and I only wanted 6. But now we're going to share bedrooms.
Right.
So, and then the workshop locally here, same thing. I have a San Diego list, which is only about 300 people. So I just sent it to my San Diego list.
Very nice. So what has been your greatest business success? And on the flip side, if you have a failure to share as well, because we've learned so much from our failures, that would be great.
I think the greatest business success have been my CDs because, you know, I'm not a professional musician. I have a commitment to never hurt anybody. I'm a good singer and I can carry a tune and I write incredibly beautiful songs. But I don't know, when I decided to put it down, like in the form of a CD, that was a big commitment. I was afraid of it because the guy said, I said, what's it going to cost me to make a CD? And David said, $1,500, just you and your guitar. He goes, $2,000, you and your guitar, me and my guitar, and 2,500, I arrange your tunes, bring in other musicians, and play guitar. Well, I said, well, of course, 1,500, me and my guitar. Because I'm an activist. I don't have discretionary income. So I say 1,500. We go into the studio. I lay down a song. I taught myself guitar just like everyone else in the 70s. And I play the same six chords over and over. So I lay down the music, and he plays it through his million-dollar speakers, and I practically cry. I'm horrible. So I say, okay, 2,000, you and your guitar. And so then he plays my songs, my voice, his guitar. And then I listen to it, and it's like, this is so beautiful. But all while we're listening, he says, oh, wow, wouldn't it be great to have an accordion there? Oh, we should have a cello on that piece. And he gets me all excited, so I pay him the $2,500.
Good. Awesome.
And while he's doing it, I write three new songs. So the whole CD cost me, you know, like $3,000 altogether. I've probably made $15,000. Because now I have three CDs. They've all been through three printings, and I print 1,000 at a time. It costs less than $1 to produce once you pay your upfront costs, and they sell for $15. So do the math. That's what's paying my trip to San Juan next month.
Those are great. Again, you've got some great numbers. I love it.
Yeah.
Good profit. Any business failures that you really learned from that you'd like to share?
Business failures.
Something you can look back on and say, if I'd known then what I know now, what would I have done differently?
I have some things I've produced that I don't make. Like I did a book called Born Gay, Images and Reflections of an Ordinary Lesbian, which started out as a photo exhibition for Syracuse Stage, the theater company. Whenever they bring a play into town, they ask the artists in the community to create an exhibition that's consistent with the theme of the play. So they were bringing the play Rent into Syracuse, which is a gay lesbian theme play. And so I said, I'll be the artist. And so I did an exhibition called Born Gay, which starts out with these big, you know, 11 by 14 pictures of me at age 6 months, age 3, age 5, kindergarten graduation, first dumb boyfriend, high school prom, postulant in the religious community, riding my motorcycle. You know, so probably 25, 30 photos of me, all black and white, big, big, big photos mounted, and then text panels, which tell the story of what it was like to, the first one just says born gay, March 5th, 1949. And then age 3, you know, how I loved it when my mom's home bureau ladies came and held me in their arms and I could smell how they smelled and be nuzzled up in their bosom. And it was just so, you know, so the whole story of this little kid who grows up at kindergarten falling in love with a third grade Miss Mahan. You know, I'm gay right from the start. And it just tells the whole story up until getting kicked out of the convent, you know, and all the oppression that I felt and how I became radicalized. And it's the whole evolution of an activist. And I turned it, after the exhibition came down, I turned it into a book. And it's just what they call saddle stitch. It's not perfectly bound. It only, you know, it just got done at a local printer. Probably cost $2 or $3 each. I print 1,000. Well, it went out of print last year. And I said, oh, no, I can't have Born Gay out of print because I need it around when some parent come that's struggling with it or some teenage, you know, it's preventing suicides, you know. And so I took it back to press. It was a totally not good financial idea because now it's costing me $2,500. I still got 1,000 of them in my shed taking up space. I have no marketing plan for it. It's not a fiscally responsible choice. And I give them out whenever there's trouble. And if I see a gay and lesbian conference come into town, I email them and I'll say, I'll drop off 200 of these for your front table. Give them away. So I wouldn't call that a failure, but I would say that's what Jan looks like when she's not being fiscally smart, is that's what she does.
It's still great marketing, though, because you're giving them out and people still get to see who you are and get to know you. So I bet you it's going to turn around in one way or another. You're going to see it come back.
Hey, you're probably right. It's like a calling card.
Yeah. I always say books are like big, expensive business cards.
That's true, and that's how we should think of them, because you're not going to get rich on a book.
No.
Well, I don't know. Stephen King is. And so did, what's her name, Rowling.
Yes.
She's the only billionaire who ever made money on a book like that.
The true exception, a phenomenon to everything. So speaking of books, what is a book that you would recommend that you can't live without? Could be spiritual, could be business, a combination. What would that book be?
I think the Sufi mystics, for me, give me permission to be a contemporary mystic. So Rumi and Hafiz both. Rumi, translated by Coleman Barks. You know, poetry. I just took a 3-day painting class because I was paralyzed in front of a empty sheet of watercolor paper. And I said, uh-oh, I'm being fraudulent because I'm teaching people how to unlock their cells creatively, and here I am having a panic attack in front of a blank sheet of watercolor paper. So I took a 3-day painting class, and he started it out with a Hafiz poem every day because there's a direct relationship, because what that does is burrow into your right brain. You know, poems just shovel out the crap and really allow us access into our deeper zones. So I would say it's Mary Oliver and Rumi who really most expand my imagination to do the great work. It's none of the left brain books. None of them. Nobody needs a how-to book, but we all need why-to help.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm writing. The book I'm working on now is called Stop Learning, Start Knowing, a why-to book on creativity.
Love that. That's beautiful.
Because if you know why you're doing what you're doing, you keep sailing. But if you think it's about how, you don't. You get all, you know, your engine sputters out.
Yeah,
not about how.
Having the inspiration is the key. So where do you see yourself going from here? What's your next steps in your platform? Or are you just content with where you are?
Well, I'm always interested in reaching more people because of that whole thing. Someone out there needs me. How do they find me? So I know there's masses of people. I mean, there's already scientific research about the millions of people that are leaving churches. And so those are the people who need me. Because if they think they can't have a spiritual path because they left religion, that's a screwed up idea. And so they need to get unscrewed up, and I'm the one. So I'm pretty much doing my same marketing in the same way, but I'm evolving constantly because life goes through me. Life is changing me daily. And so as a result of my evolution, I'm more prolific and I'm writing more books. You know, I have a pile up of to-do things. And so I think I will, every other book, maybe have a publisher publish it and then go back and do one for my own self so I can make some money and go back and forth. I'm considering having an agent because I would like to have Hay House do one because they do well by their agent. They do well by their writers. If you're a writer speaker, which I am, I'm half writer, half speaker, then Hay House is a good venue for your material because they create these. You know, they have Hay House cruises, Hay House conferences, etc. But you can't get in there without an agent.
Right.
You know, and I had an agent once and I just fired him because I found a publisher before he did. So, you know, we're always having, it's a constant dance, shape-shifting. What, you know, what do you need for this? Because my audience doesn't really change, but culture's changing pretty radically.
Yeah.
Right. And we're identifying, you know, you hear every newscaster about every other paragraph, they use the word narrative. So the culture is finally catching up that it's all about story. So I'm helped that, hence my story spinning work, right?
Right.
And so to keep ourselves current is to keep our ears tuned to the great below, to hear the rumblings before the mass hears the rumblings, and start offering it before, you know, every Joe Blow is offering it.
Yep, it's the early bird gets the worm, right? You've got to first one out there with it.
Right.
So if my listeners did want to find you and find out more about your amazing work, where would they go look for you?
Well, they would just Google Jan Phillips like everyone else.
Perfect.
And that takes you right to my website. And it also will take you right to Living Kindness, so you could see my, you know, noble work in the world. But in my idea, it's all the same. It's all spiritual. It's all noble. It's all about service. It's just two websites because one has to do with the work in Africa. But, yeah, I make myself really easy to find.
Fantastic. Well, my listeners can go out and hunt you down and go to your next workshop. And thank you so much for your time. It's been absolutely lovely speaking with you.
You have been listening to The Mindful Marketing Show with me, your host, Kimberly Maska. You can get more information about this episode and all of my episodes at mindfulmarketingshow.com. There you'll find all of the show notes and links to the books and business resources we discussed. Again, that's mindfulmarketingshow.com. Until next time, be passionate, be inspired, and live your dream. Have a beautiful day.